This is the Southwest
Christadelphian Bible School, the 7th of July, 1997. This is Class 1. Our speaker is Brother Roger Lewis from Christ Church Ecclesia, New Zealand. His first subject is entitled Samuel the Seer. Today's title is Samuel Was Old and Made His Son Judges. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ and my dear young people. This morning we're going to start our studies on the life of Samuel, and we'll start with a picture of him. By the way, you might have thought that I don't know how to put overheads on the screen. Now, we've got a slight technical hitch here, have we? Can you hear me if I move across this way? Okay, so I'm not really magnified as over there, but you can still hear me, is that right? Been carefully drawn, because what we wanted to convey, in fact, was an old man. An old man. We have success. I can move. The wonders of wonders, the technical hitch has been resolved. Now, the picture of Samuel here as an old man was done deliberately, because the funny thing about this study is that we're really going to be looking at Samuel in oldness of age. Do you notice that it said in the first of Samuel, chapter 8 and verse 1 there, it came to pass when Samuel was old. Now, I don't know if you've ever considered this with regard to the implications of the divine narrative, but just have a look at this in terms of the history of Samuel's life. You see, Samuel first appears, of course, in chapter 1, in the first book of the first chapter of the first of Samuel. We're told that he appears there as a child. And in those first three chapters, chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 3, we have the story of Samuel as a little boy, from the moment of his birth to the time that he is presented by Hannah to temple service, the story of his growth in the second chapter, and the story of his calling as a prophet in the third chapter, when the voice comes to him, remember, at night time, crying, Samuel, Samuel, and he ran to Eli. So this is the story, you see, of Samuel as a young child. And we've got 53 verses on that part of his life. And then you'll find that when we come to chapter 4 of the first of Samuel, that he's not there. He's not in chapter 4, he's not in chapter 5, he's not in chapter 6. And then all of a sudden, by the time we come to chapter 7, there he is in full maturity of life as a mature leader. And this is the only chapter that we have that looks at really the bulk of his time, the bulk of his work as a judge in Israel, covering about 40 years of his life. Chapter 7, just chapter 7, you see. And then all of a sudden, we come to chapter 8, verse 1, which is what we've done this morning, and we find that we suddenly have Samuel as an old man. And now we're going to have him in chapter 8, in chapter 9, in chapter 10, in chapter 11, in chapter 13, in chapter 15, in chapter 16, in chapter 19. And we suddenly realize that the very focus of the divine record itself is on Samuel's labors as an old man. Do you notice that? There's only a few verses, 53 verses on him as a young child. There's only 17 verses on him as a mature leader. And there are 147 verses on Samuel as an old man. Isn't that remarkable? Now, why would the record ignore the bulk of his work as a judge in Israel and focus on what he did by the time he'd come to oldness of age? Well, you see, we think there are reasons for that. And we hope to try and examine those reasons, God willing, in the course of our first study this morning. Samuel was what we might call a trailblazer. He was one of the great trailblazers. And you see, there were a whole series of these, weren't there, down through the divine record of time. We haven't got time to look at this in detail, so let me just show it to you on the screen, but it'll give you the idea. You see, I think that right down through the scriptural narrative, there were a whole series of men who were the trailblazers. Here they are down this side, you see. There was Moses, there was Samuel, there was Elijah, there was John, there was Paul. In fact, I've come through to the modern day and put Brother Thomas at the end because I think there's a similarity of thought here. You see, these were the trailblazers, the preparers of the way, the breakers of the ground, the clearers of the path. And after each of these men came another who was of a different spirit and who had a different work to perform. And so after Moses came Joshua. And whereas Moses was he that redeemed the nation from Egypt, Joshua was the one who would finally organize the tribes and settle the nation in the land in their due and proper way. And his work was every bit as important as Moses, but it was a different work. His was the work of establishing and consolidation. And now we're going to come to the life of Samuel, and we're going to find that he is the man who will redeem the nation from apostasy and establish the monarchy in the land. And yet after him will come David, who will organize the tabernacle worship and write the spiritual psalms of Israel. And then there'll be Elijah, who redeems the nation from Baal worship and from the time of the apostasy of Omri's dynasty. And yet he'll be followed by Elisha, a much more quiet man, who will be responsible for organizing the prophets, for performing miracles of healing, for teaching in the land. You see how the one followed the other all the way through this cycle here? A set of trailblazers and the men that followed after. Well, Samuel's a trailblazer, you see. He's in the mould of Moses. He's after the manner of Elijah. He shows, in a sense, the spirit of John. He's like the Apostle Paul. And you'll find that there is a strange relationship between these trailblazers. Samuel is going to quote Moses. Paul is going to quote Samuel. You'll find there's a spirit that binds these men together because they were the trailblazers. And we're going to see very much, I think, the nature of that work in terms of Samuel's labors in the course of our studies. So, you see, we're going to start with him from the moment that he becomes an old man. We're not going to look at him as a young child. We're not even going to look at him in the maturity of his labors. We're going to meet up with him at the very time that he's first become old. Now, we might come back to the 1st of Samuel, chapter 8 and verse 15, because I think that's really where our story starts, for purposes of our study today. The 1st of Samuel chapter 8 and verse 15. Because there we're told that Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he went from year to year in circuit to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah and judged Israel in all those places, and his return was to Ramah, for there was his house, and there he judged Israel, and there he built an altar unto Yahweh. So you notice some interesting things in these verses. First of all, it says that Samuel in verse 15 judged Israel all the days of his life. Now, you see, he wasn't the leader all the days of his life, was he? You see, there were kings that were going to arise. In fact, Samuel was going to anoint them. There was going to be Saul, and then there was going to be David. And yet somehow, verse 15 implies, that even after the ascension of Saul as king, that much of Samuel's influence and authority in the land remained. There was a sense, you see, in which Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, even after there were kings ascended the throne. So venerable was his character, so respected were his views. He was going to remain, you see, as a father figure to the nation until the time of his death. And these first two kings who would ascend the throne, Saul and David, would find looming up behind them was this great man who was their counselor and their guide, the man who judged Israel all the days of his life. You notice what it says there, verse 15, he judged Israel. Verse 16, he judged Israel. Verse 17, he judged Israel. You see, the record tells us three times here that he was the judge of Israel. This was probably about 40 years of his work. 40 years of his life was spent doing this. And yet, you know something that's remarkable? You know, from the moment Samuel dies, that there's only one further reference in the Bible to him as a judge. Even though that was really the bulk of his work, there's only one other reference after his death to Samuel as a judge. And every other occasion, he's called a prophet, not a judge. He's called a prophet, not a judge. Now, there's a reason why. Why would that be? In the New Testament, he is only ever described as a prophet, never as a judge. And yet that was where the bulk of his work went, was on judging Israel. Now, why would that be? Well, we hope to come to that reason in the course of our study this morning. Verse 16, by the way, implies that really you would almost get the idea that his work was very limited, because you see these cities here, Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah, Ramah, they all fall really within the tribal canton of Benjamin, you see. And one could be forgiven for imagining that here really was a judge in a little circuit in his own little area in Israel. No, Samuel's influence was much larger than that. We haven't got time to turn up the references, but you may like to take a note of the 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 20, that says in the time of the establishment of the king that Samuel gathered all Israel. Again, chapter 12 and verse 1, which is a study that we'll look at later on, when Samuel resigns his office of responsibility, it says that he speaks to all Israel. In chapter 25 and verse 1, when Samuel dies, it says that all Israel lamented him. Oh no, his influence was throughout the nation as a whole, no doubt about that. And therefore, even though he walked in this circuit, you see, from Bethel to Gilgal, Mizpah to Ramah, there must have been a sense in which the elders from the various tribes travelled to one of those cities that they might meet with Samuel. He acted as a circuit judge, almost, we might describe him as. But he dealt with matters that flowed into his jurisdiction from all parts of the nation. He was the judge of the nation as a whole, you see. And his return was to Ramah, his beloved Ramah, because there was his house, and there he judged Israel, and there he builded an altar unto Yahweh. So now verse 1 says, of chapter 8, it came to pass when Samuel was old. Interesting, actually, if you look up the Hebrew word, zokan, the Hebrew word means to be old. So this is one of these really interesting times when the Hebrew word really advances our understanding of the English word. It means to be old. So that's really helpful. And, of course, the question is, how old is old? And you see, I think that's why we need to have Englishman's concordance as well as Strong's. Because, you see, the great value of Englishman's, isn't it, is that it takes the Hebrew word and says, well, look, here's every time that this word is found in the Bible narrative. And that really starts to develop our understanding of how a word is used in Scripture in its own contextual setting. In fact, I believe that Englishman's Greek and Englishman's Hebrew are really the most important concordances of all. More important than Strong's. Strong's gives us the idea of a word and perhaps the derivation of the roots, but the great advantage of Englishman's is it gives us the value of a word set in its own contextual setting of its own verse. Now, here are some of the places where that word's used. This is the word, you see, used of Abraham in chapter 18 of Genesis, in Genesis chapter 18, verse 11, when he is so old that it says he was past fathering children. This is the word used of Isaac in Genesis chapter 27 and verse 1, where it says his eyes were dimmed. This is the word used of David in the 1 Kings, chapter 1 and verse 1, where it says that he gat him no heat. And Abishag the Shunammite, a young maiden of Israel, was brought unto the king. This is the word used of Jehoiada in the 2 Chronicles, chapter 24 and verse 15, when it says he waxed old, a man whose life was miraculously extended, we believe, so that when he died he was 130, unheard of in that time. This is the word translated old here. And you see, I think that the idea that's conveyed behind all that passages is, well, you see, you notice, it's the time when a person could no longer father children, when the eyes are beginning to grow dim, when there are problems with the circulation. It's all to do with the fading of the powers of life, isn't it? The bodily functions begin to deteriorate. And you see, I think we're being told here in this first verse that Samuel felt the burden of office because of his age, however old that was. No doubt something around about 60 years of old, of age. 60 or older. Of course, you know, you can feel these things earlier, by the way. You don't have to wait till 60. Some people feel these at 40. It's not specifically to do with the year, but how you feel, you see. And Samuel felt the fading of his powers. He felt that it was difficult. Really, the action that he had here, I think, we won't turn it up, but you'll remember these words in Exodus chapter 18. I think he acted after the spirit of Moses, you see. Exodus 18, verses 21 to 23 had said, "Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers, and let them judge the people in everything. And so it shall be easier for thyself," says Exodus, "and they shall bear the burden with thee." And I think Samuel needed that, you see. He needed to share the burden. Any problem was, you see, the requirement of Exodus 18, verse 21 was, men of truth, hating covetousness. Hating covetousness. And that was where these particular boys that he was going to appoint to office here in chapter 8 of the first of Samuel, where his boys, in fact, were going to let him down. Because, of course, they were going to be men of covetousness, weren't they, as the third verse is going to go on to tell us. You see what the second verse says? It says, "The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abiah, or Abiah, and they were judges in Beersheba." You know, we often talk about the meaning of Bible names and the significance of them. We've often said that the meaning of Bible names is related to the outworking of the character of a person, the nature of their labours and the truth. Of course, sometimes, both in the Bible and in ecclesial life, children grow up only to disgrace the Bible name that they've been given. But you see, I think another thing that's interesting about Bible names is not only are they always prophetic or symbolic, but really they give us an insight, don't they, into the attitude of the parents who so named them. It's an indication of the desire of the parents for their children. So what did Samuel want for his boys? Well, he called the firstborn Joel, which means the power of Yah. And he called the second Abiah, which means Yahweh is father. Oh yes, you see, I think Samuel wanted his sons to grow up loving the truth. He wanted them to grow up strong in the truth. And he called them names indicative of his own passion for the truth, to do that which was right, and to serve Yahweh their God. It says they were judges in Beersheba, actually, in the second verse. Beersheba, of course, well to the south. I think, by the way, why they were there was this. If you come back to chapter 7 for a moment, you'll notice these words in the 13th verse. Chapter 7, verse 13 says, "So the Philistines were subdued, and they came no more into the coast of Israel. And the hand of Yahweh was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron even unto Gath, and the coasts thereof did Israel deliver out of the hand of the Philistines." So you see, there had been great victories against the enemies of Israel during the time of Samuel. Now we're told in the book of Genesis, on at least two occasions, in Genesis 21, verses 32 to 34, and in Genesis chapter 26, and verses 26 to 33, that the area of Beersheba was in the land adjacent to the Philistines. So you see, if there's been territory recovered from the Philistines as a result of the success of Israel in battle under the time of Samuel, then obviously there was administration needed in this region recently recovered from the enemies of Israel. And so his two sons were sent down to that area, you see, that they might administer the region. Once belonging to the Philistines, now back in the hands of Israel. Problem is, of course, that as a result of being all the way down in Beersheba, that they were a long way away from Dad, weren't they? Who was all the way up in Benjamin, in Ramah. And the troubles began, as the third verse says, "His sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment. Do you think, brothers and sisters, do you think Samuel would have ever appointed his sons to office if he had been aware of their covetousness? No, I don't think he would he? And I think the reason why he wouldn't have is because I think there were words ringing in the ears of Samuel that he'd never forgotten from the time that he was a little boy. Remember these words in the first of Samuel, chapter 3, when Samuel woke up one morning, one terrible morning, and he had to say these words to Eli in the first of Samuel 3 in verse 13. "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile, and he, Eli, restrained them not. And therefore I have sworn unto the house of Eli that the iniquities of Eli's house shall not be purged with sacrifice nor offering forever." And Samuel had had to himself utter those words of condemnation against Eli for the wickedness of his sons. I don't think Samuel ever forgot that. I can't imagine for a moment that he would have appointed his sons to these offices of responsibility if he'd been aware that this is what they were going to do. And later on we're going to come to what he did do with his sons, by the way, once he found out. You see, the great sin of Eli was not just that his sons were wicked. The real problem with Eli, wasn't it, is the record says, not just that his sons made themselves vile, but that Eli restrained them not. The ground of judgment was not that his sons had gone astray, but that Eli didn't do anything about the matter. I don't think Samuel was like that. You'll find that Samuel acts faithfully in this matter once he knows. But isn't there a great tragedy here? You see, three men in a row, Eli, Samuel, and after Samuel will come David, and all three are going to have sons who turn astray and who walk not in the ways of the truth. I think there's a lesson here, you see. There's a great lesson, isn't there? Why do you think that Samuel's sons were not upright? Why do you think they walked astray? Why did they leave the truth in this way? Well, I think one of the reasons is because of chapter 7 and verse 16. Because, you see, it says, doesn't it, that he went from year to year in circuit to Bethel, to Gilgal, to Mizpah, and then home to Ramah, verse 17. So, you see, Samuel was often away from home, wasn't he? He was busy in the work of the truth. So was David. And I think somehow, in the midst of the labours of these men, great though they were, there wasn't enough time with sons, you see. And these sons grew up perhaps at the crucial time of their life when they needed the contact of dad. They needed time together in scriptural matters. They needed that sense of leadership within the house, and Samuel wasn't home. He was busy on his circuit. What a tragedy, brothers and sisters, in the truth, if our sons should grow up to let us down, to undo the good that the Father has done. So this is a great charge to all fathers, isn't it? That whatever our labours might be, whatever our responsibilities in the truth, our families rank as priority. We're told, aren't we, in the Bible, in the scriptures, in the book of Psalms, that children are an heritage of Yahweh. You notice what it says, by the way, an heritage of Yahweh, not from Yahweh. Children are not the heritage of God that he's given us. Children are the heritage of God that belongs to him. He's lent them to us so that we might return them to him. And our great responsibility in life is to bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, that in due time we might give them back to him, because they're his heritage, you see. Now you can imagine how Samuel must have felt as this story unfolded, because we're told in verse 4 that all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, "Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." You imagine how that would have hurt Samuel, knowing that the very reason that the nation had given for the establishment of a king, the very grounds for their argument, was that his own sons could not judge righteous judgment. Oh, how that must have stung the old man. It must have hurt him deeply. Actually, you see what it says in verse 5? It says, they said unto him, behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like the nations. Now, you know, Bible study, good Bible study, is really all about good Bible reading. We're going to talk about this with the teenagers. We're going to run some classes with the teenagers on how to do Bible study. We're going to look at the keys to become an excellent contextual scholar of the Word. We're going to look at the outline of how to build a study program. In fact, I'm going to send all the teenagers away, God willing, by the end of this Bible school with their first 80 subjects to study in the Scriptures, just in case they didn't know how to start or where to begin or what to do. The first 80 subjects they'll go away with that they can have a look at. And you see, one of the things that we're going to say there is that really good Bible study is all about good Bible reading. And good Bible reading is reading alertly so that we catch the details and that we hear the echoes of the Bible. Now, you see, there's an echo here. When the elders say in verse 5, make us a king to judge us like the nations, that's coming from another place in the Bible. That's already been mentioned. This phrase, this passage has already been spoken. Now, where's that? Well, the margin's actually correct. It's in the book of Deuteronomy. We might just turn back to that for a minute because, you see, I think what the elders were doing here is that they were quoting scripture, you see, to Samuel. They were reminding him of a provision in the law. And they were clearly quoting from it because the very words they use in the Hebrew are drawn identically from this particular passage. Deuteronomy chapter 17, of course, had said in the 14th verse these words. The record says, when thou art come into the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom Yahweh thy God shall choose, one from among his brethren. Now, you see the word set there. It's found in verse 14, I will set a king, and also in verse 15, thou shalt in any wise set him. Now, do you know that that's the same word translated make in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 8 and verse 5? So that when they came to him and said, make us a king, what they really meant was set us a king. That's clearly an allusion to the terms of Deuteronomy, isn't it? And what did they say in Samuel? They said in the 1st of Samuel 8, verse 5, set us a king to judge us. And then look at this expression, like all the nations. And that's Deuteronomy 17 as well, isn't it? You see the end of verse 14, I will set a king over me like as all the nations. So you see, I think the elders of Israel were actually quoting Deuteronomy to Samuel. And basically what they were saying was this. They said, look, Samuel, you've got to realize that you're old. You're not a young man anymore. And the nation needs rulership and needs guidance and needs administration, and you're not going to be around forever. The day is going to come, Samuel, when you'll be gone. And who are we going to have then as our ruler and as our guide? Because your sons are no good. We can't rely on your sons. They walk not in thy ways. Now you'll remember, Samuel, that there was a provision in the law of Moses that the day would come when the nation could establish a king. And we think the time has come. So they're quoting Deuteronomy to him, you see, and suggesting that the moment for establishing the kingdom had come. Of course, I wonder if they'd really read Deuteronomy carefully, which said that if they were to set such a king over them, then it shall be the one whom Yahweh thy God shall choose. And as events were to transpire, the first king of Israel wasn't really going to be the one whom Yahweh had chosen at all, was he? The second king was, but not the first. The first king was going to be a king chosen very much after the heart and spirit of the nation, what they imagined would be a good king. Well, verse 6 tells us, and quite understandably so, that the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. The thing displeased Samuel. Josephus says that Samuel could not eat or sleep, but agitated all night on the matter. He was deeply upset by this episode. And I think there were three reasons why Samuel was bitterly unhappy with this whole suggestion. The first thing, of course, was the knowledge that the irresponsible behavior of his sons had provided the very grounds for this request. Secondly, you see, I think he took it personally. You see, he's getting old now, and I think that he felt this as a rejection of himself, an ungrateful rebellion at the end of his days of ministry, and he found that hard to cope with. He felt that that was a slight from the nation upon himself. And he also felt, of course, that they had rejected God in the process, because Samuel had always believed that a divine theocracy was much better, much to be preferred to a monarchy. Samuel believed that. He tells us that later on in chapter 12 and verse 12. He believed that the theocracy under which they had been ruled to date, whereby God was really the king of the nation, he thought that was far superior to an earthly king. So he was deeply displeased. You know, I think there's a lovely lesson in verse 6, because you see, he was agitated so much on the matter, as we often do with the troubles of life. But you notice what he did do as a result of his agitation. Verse 6 says, and so Samuel prayed unto Yahweh. Oh, there's a good lesson there, isn't there? You know, it's a funny thing in life, but sometimes with some people, the moment they arrive at the crisis of life, the moment of difficulty, the moment of trial and trouble, they stop praying. They reach a problem in life and they're so upset that they don't pray to God. Well, that's never going to solve anything in life, is it, if we do that? You see, the great thing about Samuel here is when he was upset, he did the right thing. He took the matter to God. He prayed to God. He had the habit of prayer in his life. And he communicates with his God upon the matter. In verse 7, Yahweh said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people, and all that they have said unto thee. They have not rejected thee, they've rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works that they have done since the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day. Now therefore, hearken unto their voice, verse 9. Howbeit, protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. By the way, when it says in verse 9, show them the manner of the king, I don't think that's talking about Saul in particular. The word manner here is the Hebrew word mishpat. In fact, mishpat is a word normally translated justice, but it can also mean the actions or the rights. And I think that's the idea of the word here. Show them the style of what kingship will be like, irrespective of who's king, what the rights of a king are, what the actions of a king will be. Show them what it will be like to have a monarchy. What will it be like to be under that type of government? And he did too, because verse 10 says that Samuel told all the people, all the words of Yahweh unto the people that asked of him a king, and he said, verse 11, this will be the manner of the king, the sort of actions that you will have to endure if you have a king reigning over you. And this is what he would do, verse 11. He will require your sons for military service. Verse 12. He'll use forced labor on crown lands. And he'll want helpers for the royal arsenals. Verse 13. He'll take your daughters for service in the royal kitchens. Verse 14. He'll confiscate lands to reward his ministers. Verse 15. A subject dear to the heart of all Jewish people, he will increase personal taxation. Verse 16, he will appropriate your servants and your goods for his own purposes. And as a result of those catalogue of the actions and the rights of kings that would be exercised upon them, Samuel cries out to the nation in verse 18. He says, and you shall cry out on that day. And then look at this. Because of your king, which ye have chosen you,
You see the point? It's not God's choice here, is it? This is the desires of the nation for themselves. You cry out because of your king, which ye have chosen you, and Yahweh will not hearken you, will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, but we will have a king over us, that we may be like the nations. And God finally tells his prophet, his judge, his servant, in the 22nd verse, Yahweh said unto Samuel, hearken unto their voice and make them a king. Now you see, I think that the reason for why we have so much information about Samuel and oldness of age really emerges from this chapter, you see, as we begin our study. Because what we're being told here is that Samuel became the beginning of a terribly important part in the nation's history. He became the bridge, you see, between one way to another way. And this is what it looks like. You see, before Samuel, we had two great institutions in the land. There was the priest who took charge of spiritual things, and there was the judge who ministered in civil or secular matters. And they were the two great channels of responsibility in the nation, weren't they? The priest and the judge. But you see, now what's going to happen is that Samuel comes along, and he's going to be the bridge. He's going to be the transition that will move to a new age in Israel. It's going to usher in an entirely new order of things. The priest will remain, and so will his spiritual responsibilities. But the judge now is going to become a king. The responsibilities of government are going to move to an earthly king. But there's also going to be a new group in the land that hitherto have not been seen before. The work of the prophets. And Samuel is going to be responsible for introducing both these ideas into the history of Israel. He truly lives at the watershed here, you see. And so you'll notice that our note at the bottom summarizes that. We've said that the two great movements sprang from Samuel's work as an old man. He ended the black era of the judges and established the royal office, so ushering in the new era of the kings. And Samuel was going to be the bridge. He was going to be the link from one epoch to the next. But he would also begin that grand institution that would stand alongside the monarchy throughout successive generations as the voice and conscience of God, the order of the prophets in Israel. And he, the first illustration of that great work. And you see, now we suddenly have an inkling of why it is that the Bible focuses on Samuel as an old man. Because you see, all of this work was done from the 1st of Samuel, chapter 8, verse 1 onwards. And this is truly the greatness of Samuel's labors, isn't it? To usher in the royal office and to establish the prophetic order. And he did both of those things as an old man, you see. You notice how resistant he is to that in this chapter. You see, he had to be told by God three times, didn't he, to do this. You see that? Whereabouts is that? Verse 7, hearken unto the voice of the people. Verse 9, hearken unto their voice. And verse 22, hearken unto their voice. You see, he's an old man. He's resistant to change. And God in the end has to exhort him three times before he's prepared to move ahead in these matters of ushering in the kingship and establishing the prophetic order that would come later. But I tell you what, brothers and sisters, there's a fantastic lesson, I think, that emerges from this story. And that's this. You see, this story begins with a man who already feels the fading of his powers. And yet his greatest work was just to commence. Just about to commence. Now look at what he does as an old man. He appoints to office the first two kings. He counsels them on their responsibilities. That in itself was a great enough work. He's going to write a national constitution for the administration of Israel under the monarchy. A whole constitution for the kingdom. That's an enormous work just in itself. He's going to plan and appoint the orders and the duties that will relate to worship in the house of God, that the nation may have some spiritual organization around the kingdom. And he's also going to make sure that the whole system of worship that he's written about and written down is going to be maintained, that it can be followed up and followed through, because he's going to organize the dedication of the war spoils so that there'll always be the funds to maintain the system of worship in Israel. He had foresight, this man. This is the man who's going to revitalize the standard and fervor of the nation's celebration of the feasts so that they would become the benchmark for all later times as to the heights of spirituality in the nation. This is the man who's going to establish the prophetic order so that the spiritual direction of the nation might be continued. And if that wasn't enough, brothers and sisters, we're told at the end there that just to sort of round off his labors, he wrote a history of the times to chronicle the transition of the nation to the monarchy. Now, I'll tell you what, brothers and sisters, these are the labors of an old man. They'd leave most young men gasping, wouldn't they? You see, once Samuel is convinced that this is God's objective, it's almost scary, the degree of dedication that he now focuses on fulfilling God's objectives. It's an enormous task that he accomplishes in the years of his life as an old man. Well, God willing, brothers and sisters, these are the things and the matters that we will explore in the course of the studies to come as we trace that marvelous work of Samuel in the chapters that follow, all of which sprang from this notable time that we've read of this morning when it says, "And it came to pass, when Samuel was old, and he made his sons judges."